Welcome, everybody. Let's go ahead and get started. So we're glad to have such a great turnout at the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series today. We'll hear a reading from Andrew Epstein, Dr. Andrew Epstein, our very own.
And please join me in welcoming the person who will be introducing our speaker tonight, Tom Bevilacqua.
It is truly an honor to introduce Dr. Andrew Epstein to you tonight, and I don't say that flippantly, for Dr. Epstein is such an important member of the literary community here at Florida State and a great model of what a scholar and professor, I can deal with this, a great model of what a scholar and professor of literature should be. It really is a privilege to tell you a bit about him and his work. And I'd like to start by mentioning something that sets Dr. Epstein apart from many other literary scholars. He's a published poet whose work has appeared in a wide swath of poetry journals. And I note this not only because, as a burgeoning literary scholar who dabbles in creative writing, I find this quite inspiring, but that between this fact and his presence at the literary events that happen in Tallahassee, you can see someone who clearly cares about poetry and literature, whether it be from the past or it be contemporary. And this also reflects an appreciation and attention paid to the craft of poetry and the workings of the poem, something Dr. Epstein incorporates into his classroom as well. I was lucky enough to take Dr. Epstein's graduate seminar on American modernist poets, and it was not only one of the best courses of my graduate student career, but also one of the most useful. I find that up to this day, whenever I'm asked about those poets we discussed, such as T.S. Eliot or William Carlos Williams or Marianne Moore or Wallace Stevens, to name a few, I refer back to our discussions in that class. By its end, I felt as though I knew how to talk at least somewhat coherently about those poets, which, given the difficulty and obscurity of the modernists, was perhaps not the most likely of outcomes for me. Yet Dr. Epstein's approach to teaching is one that can navigate students through the most challenging and difficult waters of modernist poetry. And while providing the appropriate context, whether of a historical or theoretical nature, Dr. Epstein made sure we never lost sight of the poems and the poets themselves, as our discussion would always return to them. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't add that in his classes that focus on poetry of the latter half of the 20th century, Dr. Epstein will incorporate the work of Lou Reed in The Velvet Underground. Now, if there's anything cooler than a poet or a professor, bringing The Velvet Underground into the equation, I'd really like to know what that is. But what we're here for tonight, however, is Dr. Epstein's outstanding scholarly work. In addition to his many articles and essays on the poets of the New York School of Poetry, along with others from the post-war American poetic landscape, Dr. Epstein has written two masterful works of literary criticism. In his 2006 book, Beautiful Enemies, Friendship and Postwar American Poetry, he examines, quote, postwar American poetry's obsession with friendship and its pleasures, limitations, contradictions, arguing that this troubling yet generative clash between friendships and nonconformity is central to post-World War II American poetry and its communities, by investigating, quote, investigating the peculiar dynamics of American avant-garde poetic communities and the uneasy role of the individual within them, end quote, focusing on the work of Omri Baraka, John Ashbery, and Frank O'Hara. But what we'll be hearing from tonight is his most recent work, Attention Equals Life, The Pursuit of the Everyday in Contemporary Poetry and Culture, in which Dr. Epstein notes the emergence in the mid-20th century of, quote, poets who began to explore the connections between poetry, attention, and the everyday, end quote, and exploring their relationship with, quote, a disparate group of thinkers who, in one way or another, take the everyday to be an essential issue and problem, end quote. Looking at poets such as James Schuyler, Bernadette Meyer, Ron Silliman, Claudia Rankine, and my favorite, A.R. Ammons, Dr. Epstein has written, in the words of one reviewer, quote, a wonderful book that sensitizes us to the way that a strain of experimental poetry has sought to attend to daily life in all its complexity and obscurity without desiring to transcend it. With this book, Dr. Epstein has made another important contribution to the critical discourse surrounding American literature and provides an example of the kind and quality of work those of us in the world of literary scholarship should strive to produce with his rigorous and thoughtful consideration of these poets and their work. Andrew Epstein is the author of Attention Equals Life, The Pursuit of the Everyday in Contemporary Poetry and Culture, Oxford University Press, 2016, and Beautiful Enemies, Friendship in Postwar American Poetry, Oxford University Press, 2006. He is a professor at Florida State University, and he writes about the New York School of Poets on his blog, Locus Solus, http://newyorkschoolpoets.wordpress.com. It's quite good. I really enjoy his website, too. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Andrew Epstein to the stage.
Hey, everybody. Let's see. How's that? That's fine. Hi. Thank you, Tom, wherever you are, Tom, for that wonderful introduction. And thank you all for being here. It's really great to see so many friends and colleagues and students here. I want to thank Laura Miner for having the idea in the first place for me doing this. And it's going to go on the whole time. I wanted to thank Aaron Ballou also for inviting me. And it's really exciting to be here, to be able to talk about my book with you guys. And it's not really our common practice to have scholars and critics talking about literary criticism in this series, but we have done it before a couple of times, and hopefully it's something we can do more of. There's some books in the back, which I didn't expect, and I was going to say something about how, for those of you who don't know, scholarly books from university presses can be quite expensive, unfortunately. So mine is priced rather high. There's a stack of flyers back there with a discount code on it if you're interested in purchasing it that way. I think that's it. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about how I decided to write a book about this topic, the poetics of everyday life, and then I'm going to read a few sections from different parts of the book along with some poems along the way that will illustrate what I'm talking about. So quite a long time ago, I came to the realization that a lot of the stuff that I've always loved reading, not all of it, but a lot of it, was extremely attentive to the small and usually overlooked details of daily life. Even way back in high school, I remember being kind of blown away when I read lines like these from Preludes by T.S. Eliot. The winter evening settles down with smell of steaks in passageways, 6 o'clock, the burnt out ends of smoky days. The morning comes to consciousness of faint, stale smells of beer from the sawdust-trampled street with all its muddy feet that press to early coffee stands. I remember being 16 or 17 and thinking, wow, the smell of steaks at dusk, the burnt-out ends of smoky days, stale smells of beer, I can relate to that, you know, and all those muddy feet rushing to early morning coffee stands. I just couldn't believe that poetry and art could be about stuff that seems so unbeautiful, so familiar, so routine, things we all do and have experienced day in and day out, or that writing could render it so vividly and memorably. In college, I fell for poets like Frank O'Hara and James Wright. James Wright, who I ended up writing my senior thesis about, wrote a famous poem about lazing around in somebody else's backyard and doing quite literally nothing except watching and listening to what's happening around him. It's called Lying in a Hammock at William Duffy's Farm in Pine Island, Minnesota. It goes like this. Over my head, I see the bronze butterfly asleep on the black trunk, blowing like a leaf in green shadow. Down the ravine behind the empty house, the cowbells follow one another into the distances of the afternoon. To my right, in a field of sunlight between two pines, the droppings of last year's horses blaze up into golden stones. I lean back as the evening darkens and comes on. A chicken hawk floats over, looking for home. I have wasted my life. I was taken with just about everything in this poem, from the weird specificity and ordinariness of the title, Lying in a Hammock at William Duffy's Farm. Like, who's William Duffy? And Pine Island, Minnesota seems so unpoetic and specific. I love the way it isolates and frames a tiny moment in which nothing of major import seems to be happening. Relaxing in a hammock, looking at a butterfly, hearing some cowbells, seeing some cow shit on the ground flaring up like pieces of gold. And of course, that notorious, unexpected leap of a last line, I have wasted my life. At the same time, I was drawn to the idea that an entire novel could be written about a single day, and a fairly regular day at that. some of my very favorite books, which also blew me away early on, take on this challenge, such as James Joyce's Ulysses, or Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, or The Mezzanine by Nicholson Baker, which, if you know that book, it takes place in the space of time it takes for the protagonist to ride an escalator back to his office from a lunch break trip to the CVS store. It became clear to me that while this was a pretty familiar feature of modern literature, scholars hadn't really explored it enough as a major shift in writing, art, or culture. At the same time, I realized that a number of important philosophers and critical theorists were also preoccupied with the everyday at pretty much the same time as the shift is occurring in literature and art, but poetry critics hadn't really noticed the parallels. I'm talking about a range of thinkers who focus on the everyday as a subject and a problem for philosophy and cultural theory, from American philosophers like Emerson and William James, to European philosophers like Heidegger and Wittgenstein, to French theorists who have books with titles like The Critique of Everyday Life, Everyday Life in the Modern World, and The Practice of Everyday Life. I decided that the work of these thinkers seemed to offer a useful conceptual vocabulary for how to understand and analyze the poetry that I was drawn to. So I set out to write a book about why the everyday becomes such a preoccupation for literature and culture, where it comes from, why it seems to pick up steam since the mid-20th century and seems to be ubiquitous at the moment. I started gathering examples, not just from poetry, but from the visual arts, movies, music, and from various places across contemporary culture, including everything from YouTube clips to Facebook self-documentation to iPhone apps. More and more I realized an obsessive fascination with the everyday is everywhere today. I wanted to figure out why, and also why a hunger for the everyday so frequently seems to drive people to invent new forms, why it leads them to imagine new kinds of novels, to undertake unusual personal projects and experiments, to develop new iPhone apps, and to write new kinds of poems. So I'm going to read a little bit from the first couple pages of the book's introduction. In 1950, Frank O'Hara wrote a short poem and gave it a simple yet suggestive title, Today. In exuberant celebration of the mundane, of seemingly unpoetic everyday objects, O'Hara's poem amounts to a young poet's Ars Poetica, or a poem about poetry. Oh, kangaroos, sequins, chocolate sodas, you really are beautiful. Pearls, harmonicas, jujubes, aspirins, all the stuff they've always talked about still makes a poem a surprise. These things are with us every day, even on beachheads and beers. They do have meaning. They're strong as rocks. By stressing that these ordinary, even banal things like movie theater candy, glittery sequins, chocolate sodas really are beautiful and do have meaning, O'Hara seems to be responding to a familiar complaint about the appropriate subject matter for art. There's no room in poetry for trivial and frivolous junk like aspirins and harmonicas. Poetry must be about grand subjects, weighty issues, timeless subjects and themes, that kind of idea. This poem, with its conversational voice, its tone of fizzy affirmation, its gushing pledge of allegiance to lowly mass-produced contemporary objects, makes a provocative claim about the content of poetry, as well as about style and form. But O'Hara's Today is more than just a quintessential example of a camp aesthetic that revels in the low and relishes the banality of pop culture. As the quiet references to the Normandy beachhead and the funeral beers, that's B-I-E-R, like a funeral platform that you put a coffin on, the funeral beers of D-Day and World War II suggest, O'Hara declares that the immediate elements of our daily lives of today are with us even in the midst of historical catastrophe and personal tragedy. The everyday is not only full of beauty and meaning, but it is, as he puts it, as strong as rocks. In other words, it forms the inescapable natural foundation of human experience. Poised at the exact midpoint of the 20th century, O'Hara articulates a stance, a poetics of everyday life, that would come to dominate American poetry over the next 60 years. To put this vision into practice, he develops a distinctive brand of everyday life poetry that many of you are familiar with, that's exerted an enormous influence on contemporary poetry, perfecting what he half-jokingly calls his I do this, I do that poems. O'Hara wrote disarmingly casual works, like his famous poem, The Day Lady Died, which chronicles the poet's mundane actions and thoughts as he walks through the crowded New York streets during his lunch hour. It begins, it's 12:20 in New York, a Friday, 3 days after Bastille Day. Yes, it's 1959 and I go get a shoe shine. I walk up the muggy street beginning to sun and have a hamburger and a malted, maybe one of the first hamburgers in American poetry. In or Malteds, I guess. In an essay, O'Hara praised a friend of his for somehow giving, quote, an equation in which attention equals life or is its only evidence. This remark, which I've borrowed for the title of this study, crystallizes the creed underlying O'Hara's own aesthetic, as well as so much 20th century poetry and art. The idea that attention is such a crucial aesthetic and human faculty that in some ways it is life itself, if only because it alone has the ability to provide proof and documentation of human existence. So this book examines why a quest to pay attention to daily life has increasingly become such a central feature of both contemporary American poetry and the wider culture of which it's a part. It provides a genealogy of poetry's fascination with the everyday, considers the variety of forms that fascination takes, and examines its aesthetic, philosophical, and political ramifications. To do so, the book has chapters on a diverse group of writers, including poets from associated with influential movements like the New York School, language poetry, conceptual writing, and a wide range of others. At the same time, it explores parallel developments in a variety of other media, which means that I take up points of contact between literature and the visual arts, as well as the flourishing of these experiments and projects that I'll say more about in a minute in various parts of sort of non-literary culture. So a big question the book asks is why? Why does this why does this become such a predominant issue in the latter half of the 20th century, and even more so now in so many disparate parts of our culture? I argue that a potent hunger for everyday life explodes in the post-1945 period as a reaction to the rapid, unsettling transformations of this era, which have resulted in a culture of perilous distraction, which I think probably people are aware of, right? In recent years, debates about the problem of attention have raged in both popular media and in academia. We've seen endless hand-wringing over diminishing attention spans and fretting over the effects of new media on the human brain. As Nicholas Carr famously asked in 2008, is Google making us stupid? We've been inundated with articles and books that deplore or less often celebrate the impact of technology on how we think and our ability to focus and pay attention. These range from academic tomes to books for the general reader to self-help guides with titles, some quite alarming, like Distracted, The Erosion of Attention in the Coming Dark Age. The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, The Economics of Attention, Style and Substance in the Age of Information, Staying Focused in the Age of Distraction, How Mindfulness, Prayer, and Meditation Can Help You Pay Attention to What Really Matters. As one writer recently put it in the New York Times, attention deficit disorder is no longer a disorder in America. It is the norm. Attention is now the disorder. It's kind of scary. It seems safe to say that by the early 20th century, profound anxiety, maybe hysteria, about the fate of attention has become one of the defining issues of our time. This near panic about attention has sparked a phenomenon I call everyday hunger, a powerful craving for closer contact with the most taken for granted and familiar aspects of the quotidian, a desire for greater knowledge and more thorough documentation of our own daily lives. I'm not suggesting this is an entirely new desire, and I know my colleagues from earlier periods will say, but this was going on much earlier. In fact, the problem is probably as old as civilization itself. I mean, the philosopher Heraclitus worried over 2 millennia ago that man is estranged from that which is most familiar. So it goes way back. But the technological and social changes of modernity seem to have profoundly exacerbated this fear. With the dawning of the digital age, it's only become more pronounced and pervasive, arising in many different spheres of our culture over the past several decades, from things like reality TV, to hyper-realist fiction, to new technologies like Instagram or wearable computing devices that encourage us to constantly monitor and document our daily lives. This book argues that poetry, of all things, is an important, perhaps unlikely, cultural form that has mounted a response and even a mode of resistance to a culture suffering from an acute crisis of attention. And in doing so, poetry has developed an array of new methods for satisfying that hunger for everyday life. It's not a coincidence, I argue, that so many writers and critics today link poetry to the act of paying careful attention. For example, several years ago, the poet Edward Hirsch made precisely this connection in order to defend the value of poetry when he noted that current cultural conditions have made poetry more important than ever. We get things from poetry that we can't get from other places, Hirsch said. We live in an unprecedented situation of celebrity culture, 24-hour news media, 840 cable channels, and an amazing amount of technology, but no one is really paying attention. Poets pay attention. poets pay attention. I find it interesting that this widespread notion that poetry can be defined as a, this is a quote from somebody, as a form of attention at its most intense, or that poems should function, another quote, as vessels of attention. I find it interesting that that's become so prevalent in recent years, and I give a lot of examples in the book. This is not a timeless or natural definition of poetry. You don't see poets in other time periods and places viewing poetry in this way very often. It's rather historically conditioned and specific to our time and place, a reflexive response to widespread fears that our ability to pay attention isn't what it once was. As such, I think it constitutes a new chapter in the history of poetry as a genre. One of the chief goals of my book is to explore why this little notice shift has taken place and to examine its far-reaching implications. Attention is all, the poet Ron Silliman writes repeatedly in one of his long poems, a phrase that could be a guiding mantra for the poets and artists of the everyday. For the figures I discuss in this book, the difficult task of attending to daily life becomes a powerful motive for writing and even an ethical commandment. It's my duty to be attentive, Frank O'Hara proclaims in one poem. If it's true that today, more than ever, our ability to pay attention to what lies before us is in grave peril, as so many observers have warned, then understanding and practicing and aesthetics of the everyday is all the more urgent and timely. In the end, Attention Equals Life maintains that this attempt, which can at best be an approach rather than or a pursuit, but never an arrival, is an aesthetic, political, and ethical task of the highest order. The idea that contemporary American poetry often trains its eye on everyday experience is not a secret. It's even become something of a truism or an accepted fact. Today, it's become so pervasive in American poetry that you could pick up virtually any volume of poems recently and find poems that depict mundane experiences or revel in the low realms of popular culture or examine ordinary objects and events. Anyone who reads contemporary poetry, which a lot of you do, is probably familiar with the endless stream of reviews and blurbs for books of poetry which breathlessly exclaim that the poet discovers the extraordinary within the ordinary or transforms the everyday into something rich and strange. And I have a lot of examples of that kind of blurb language in the book. The problem is that this idea has become little more than a cliche, a convenient shorthand that fails to shed much light on the poetry itself or on the wide range of approaches to the everyday that poets actually exhibit. It doesn't offer us much help in interpreting works like many of those I deal with in this study, which tend to refuse to romanticize or idealize the everyday, and which often reject the idea that art's goal is to transform daily experience into something beyond or greater than the everyday itself. And I realized that a lot of the works that I was interested in didn't really fit this paradigm in the first place. Take, for example, some of the more extreme manifestations of this tendency, works which I find troubling and fascinating as kind of like limit cases for this, such as the plays of Samuel Beckett, like the play Happy Days, which some of you may know, which in which a woman is buried up to her waist in the first act, chattering away and desperately trying to pass the time as one day grinds endlessly into the next. In the second act, we find her inexplicably buried up to her neck, still chattering on and on. Or Waiting for Godot, in which nothing happens twice, as a critic famously said, as two men stand around throughout the first act, endlessly waiting for an event that never occurs, and then do the exact same thing all over again in the second act. Or another limit case example, Andy Warhol's notorious movie, Sleep, a 5.5-hour movie which depicts nothing other than a man sleeping for its duration. Some big moments happen when he turns over, stuff like that. So many of the poets that I discuss in this book are attracted to this kind of aesthetic, even if many don't go quite so far. But it's a mode that I refer to as an experimental realism, which leads them to present the everyday in all its everydayness, refusing to trim away its boredom, to idealize its blemishes, to redeem its banalities, or smooth over its contradictions. These experimental realists often turn away from familiar poetic forms and modes of representation, instead drawing on a whole battery of new and innovative forms and devices, including things like the deliberate evasion of closure and epiphany, or the use of fragmentation and collage, repetition, listing, cataloging, the use of found objects and found language, and the appropriation of existing texts and images. Shout out to my honors class here, which we're talking about there, and the mixing of media and blurring of genres to create hybrid works. So at the heart of this book, I look at one of these particular devices a little more than the others, which is a phenomenon that I call the Everyday Life Project. By this, I mean rule-bound, playful, procedural projects, which seem to be everywhere in recent years. These projects usually call for the individual undertaking it to engage in a certain predetermined activity, usually for a set amount of time, with the goal of channeling and documenting attention to one or more aspect of everyday experience. So it's like a kind of a process that you set up and you go through it as a kind of experiment, and then you record and document and circulate the results in some way. Just to give some examples, going back to the 70s, the French writer Georges Perec wrote down every item he ate and drank over the course of an entire year, arranging the surprisingly massive set of data into categories and calling the whole thing, this is the title, calling the whole thing, an attempt at an inventory of the liquid and solid foodstuffs ingurgitated by me in the course of the year 1974. It's wonderful, I recommend it. It's about five pages of everything Georges Perec ate and drank during the course of a year, 1974. To create his poem Skies, the poet Ron Silliman came up with his own project of attention. Every day for 1 year, I looked at the sky and noted what I saw, composing one sentence per day and stitching them all together to compose a prose poem. The poet Kenneth Goldsmith recorded every word he said for 1 week using a hidden microphone, transcribed it, and ended up with about a 500-page book of prose poetry that he called Soliloquy. It doesn't have the words of his people he was speaking to, just his words. Another writer created a poem that's a list of every brand she touched over the course of a day in chronological order, nothing else, just the brand names. It's called First My Motorola, from the moment she woke up until she went to sleep. The poet Harriet Mullen's most recent book, Urban Tumbleweed, is a sequence of 365 haiku-like little poems written one per day for exactly a year, each in conjunction with a daily walk. Clearly, everyday life projects seem to be everywhere at the moment. Nobody's really talked about it before, and not only within poetry, but in every nook and cranny of our culture. We seem to be living in an age of the project, a cultural moment that finds not only writers and artists, but also so-called everyday or ordinary people, engaging in these sort of experiments, often using new media and digital technologies in which certain conditions and rules are established and actions undertaken, and then things are recorded and circulated. For example, a viral YouTube erupted a few years ago, a video clip of called Every Day, in which a guy took one picture of himself over a six-year period and created a video in which he stitched them all together, thousands of self-portraits watching himself age sequentially while a morose kind of new agey melody plays in the background. We're very familiar with this now because you see a million of these, but there was an original one, I think, and now there's a lot of copies and imitations and parodies of this. And then there are things like the thing called 1 Second Every Day, a popular app that allows users to record a single second of video for each day and then mash the fragments together into a continuous video. It's pretty fun if you want to try it. As these examples suggest, nowadays it seems like everyone can engage in everyday life projects of attention, and many of us do, maybe without realizing how closely they resemble, you know, these earlier avant-garde experiments. So why have such projects blossomed over the past two decades, and why have they become so attractive, particularly for people who are interested in capturing the or fascinated with the everyday, both within literature and without? In the book, I explore a bunch of possible explanations for this, and I don't know if I really know for sure, but for now I can say that one reason I think such projects have been a powerful tool for the pursuit of the quotidian is that they offer us a chance to take active steps to fight back against the powerful effects of distraction that are otherwise very difficult to resist. By forcing us to take concrete steps and follow prescribed procedures that give us no choice but to change the nature and scope of our attentiveness and our habits of perception, projects seem to offer a practical antidote to the crisis of attention. So now I just wanted to turn to a few examples from some of the chapters to give you a sense of the specific kinds of things that I talk about in the book. So first is an excerpt from the book's fourth chapter, in which I look at the work of the poet Bernadette Mayer and a host of younger women poets who engage in a mode I call the poetics of the maternal everyday. Mayer wrote a book called Midwinter Day, which she set parameters for herself and decided to write a book-length poem on a single day, during the course of a single day, writing all day long while she was taking care of two small children in Lenox, Massachusetts in 1978. And she writes a kind of epic of daily life as a mother with two toddlers. I write a lot about that book, and then I look at some younger women poets who've been influenced by Mayer. And so this idea of the poetics of the maternal everyday is a feminist aesthetic that explores how daily life is never as monolithic or universal as it's sometimes made out to be, but it's rather inescapably shaped by gender. This body of work strives to represent the lived realities of being a woman and a mother, and insists on the fact that motherhood is always at some level political. So there's a Canadian poet named Susan Holbrook who has a poem called Nursery, a prose poem, which is a good example, I think, of this maternal everyday that I'm talking about. And her poem Nursery is a conceptual everyday life project of the kind I was talking about, but one that's specifically tied to the rhythms of mothering and what Julia Kristeva calls women's time. After the birth of her child, Holbrook decided to make her mothering life work for rather than against her writing, rather than being, oh, I can't have time to write, I'm too busy taking care of a baby. She decided to have it work for her and started composing a line every time she nursed her baby. As she alternates from one breast to the other each time the baby nurses, she notes the shift at the start of each sentence, so each line methodically, kind of hilariously, begins right or left. To create a work consisting of one sentence per nursing session over a period of days and weeks recalls a lot of these other projects that I was talking about, like Ron Silliman's poem Jones, in which the poet wrote a long prose poem by composing one sentence each day for a year, this time about what he saw when looking down at the ground. Holbrook, however, adds a smart and subversive twist to this kind of project, as a number of other poets in this chapter do. She turns a device often used by male writers for the purposes of being an urban flaneur or, you know, a walker around the city, exploring the daily life of the city. She takes that and she kind of turns it around into a tool for the exploration of a particularly so-called feminine or domestic experience of the daily. So the result is a 5-page piece of unbroken prose, which is a very delightful and funny ode to breastfeeding that contains a subtle but potent dose of political critique and commentary. She writes in one passage, left, try to sit you up for a burp, you're still latched on. Right, milk drops leave shiny slug trails across your cheek. Left, reading at the same time, my book on your hip, worried the officious prose style will come through in the milk, give you gas. Right, doping for sleep. Left, you spit up to make room for more, like the Romans. With bracing honesty, the poem both normalizes the act of nursing, indeed Holbrook makes it appear as natural as breathing, and shows its strangeness, its mixture of discomfort and wonder. The poem is filled with these sharply observed, awestruck evocations of the baby's tiny features and endearing actions. Your, quote, wrist is a crease circling your fist arm, sorry, your fat arm, like a too tight string. Your nostrils are wheels on a tiny pink VW Beetle. But there are also moments when the speaker notes the attendant discomforts from sore nipples, for example. Left, ugh, plug ducks. Right, how did the childless author of Tender Buttons know? Gertrude Stein. To sleep deprivation. Left, I close my eyes. These days of getting only the kind of sleep you have on planes. Holbrook is also sharply aware that the very existence of a poem on this topic is in itself a political and feminist act. She makes the stakes of writing Nursery painfully clear when she writes, right, 3 years ago in Texas, Peruvian immigrants had their children taken away when the Photoshop clerk developed their breastfeeding pictures and called the cops. A nipple in a baby's mouth was a second-degree felony. Left, dark green eye keeps darting up at me as if finally putting the face and food together. Right, I wouldn't write this poem in Texas. Suddenly, right is no longer an innocuous label denoting which breast is being suckled, but a loaded political signifier, a connection she makes explicit later in a moment of wordplay. Right, wing, whale, to lifer, to know, to die. Here, Holbrook suggests that a work of art that lavishes attention on the simple, daily, natural act of breastfeeding is still deemed controversial and is therefore an act of defiance against repression and sexist attempts to control women's bodies. By engaging in a deliberate, experimental, everyday life project of this sort, by establishing these artificial parameters and constraints, in this case, write one sentence per nursing session, alternating breasts, Holbrook's poem finds an intriguing formal means for compelling her own and our attention to the easily ignored details of a mother's daily life, while also avoiding the expected cliches and the sentimentality of other modes of writing about motherhood. And next, I wanted to take a quick look at a rather strange and experimental poem by the poet A.R. Ammons that pays extreme attention to perhaps the lowliest of the low, excrement. What could be more everyday than that? The elevation of waste and garbage as worthy of scrutiny and praise is actually a key move in the everyday life aesthetic toolkit, one that keeps recurring throughout the book. Not to turn anybody off from getting my book, but there is quite a bit about garbage and trash and waste. And we can see it in everything from the use of found materials like scraps of newspaper and cigarette wrappers in the collages of Picasso or Kurt Schwitters, or in a Francis Ponge poem called Dung, which is about dung, or a recent long poem by Brenda Cultus, which focuses on the trash she actually collects from dumpsters along the Bowery in New York City. To focus on garbage and waste in an artwork or piece of literature is a deliberately provocative gesture meant to kind of shake up our assumptions and our biases about subject matter, for example. It's also a way of putting the philosophical, ethical, and political belief in the value of daily life that we've been talking about into practice, kind of taking it to its logical endpoint or putting your money where your mouth is. Like, even shit is beautiful. Ammon's most outlandish foray in this regard, and he does this in a number of places, but he writes a poem called Shit List, or Omnium Gatherum of Diversity into Unity. It's a 45-line poem from 1979 that consists entirely of listing different kinds of animal feces. Think of it as the everyday poops of the poetry world. It begins, some of you maybe don't know that book if you don't have kids. It's a real book, Everyday Poops, Everybody Poops. it's a good one. So it begins, you'll rejoice at how many kinds of shit there are. Let me start that again. You'll rejoice at how many kinds of shit there are. Gosling shit, which Jay Williams said something was as green as. Fish shit, the generality. Trout shit, rainbow trout shit for the nice. Mullet shit, sand dab shit, casual sloth shit, elephant shit, awesome as process or payload. Wildebeest shit, horse shit, a favorite. Caterpillar shit, so many dark kinds, neatly pelleted as mint seed. Baby rhinoceros shit, splashy jaybird shit, mockingbird shit, dive-bombed with the aim of song. Robin shit that oozes white down lawn chairs or down roots under roosts. Chicken shit and chicken mite shit, pelican shit. And on it goes for 30 more rollicking lines. That's just part of it. Here we can see Ammon's irreverent reverence for the lowly and quotidian, his affection for the world's variety, and his brazen and comic refusal of poetic decorum. Also, in contrast to the James Wright poem I mentioned at the beginning, notice that what we don't find here is excrement being magically transformed into something beautiful, blazing up into golden stones. For Ammon's, it's important that shit stays shit. Ammon's poem joins a long line of list poems, but takes their Whitman-like desire to catalog and tally up the world's diversity to an extreme. From its first line forward, the point of Shit List is affirmation, as it rejoices in all the variety and awe-inspiring qualities of excrement. It also has an implicit moral dimension. Just the fact that this poem exists and that it is so joyful about shit serves to combat puritanical repression. It flies in the face of any ideological forces that would relegate such basic daily and bodily facts of life to silence and oblivion. At the same time, the piece is driven by funny little asides and precise images and vivid comparisons, like neatly pelleted as mint seed, as it revels in the pure joys of language and of naming. After all, who among us wouldn't love the phrase casual sloth shit? I thought that might be a good band name. I don't know. casual sloth shit. Much like the mockingbird's shit, this poem's own spew, its expulsion of excrement, seems dive-bombed with the aim of song. Okay, so now I'd just like to jump to the book's conclusion, which is a kind of a coda on Claudia Rankine's recent book, Citizen, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And this will be the last part. One of the main arguments of this book as a whole is that as the story of everyday life poetry evolves, we see a gradual intensification of its political stakes, an increasing commitment to using poetry to expose the workings of power and ideology in everyday practice, and to make visible the operations of gender, race, sexuality, and capitalism in daily life. In her celebrated 2014 book, Citizen, Claudia Rankine powerfully evokes the traumatic experience of everyday racism, documenting the countless microaggressions that continuously interrupt and puncture daily life for people of color. Winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award and a finalist for the National Book Award, Citizen seems to have struck a powerful chord. As the book erupted in the midst of a moment of national soul-searching regarding racism, violence, and police brutality, especially prompted by a string of incidents involving young, unarmed black men and boys being killed at the hands of white men, most often police officers. Citizen resembles the other works discussed in this book in that it takes the everyday as its province, and it too exploits an array of experimental methods to achieve its goal of attending to it. It's a genre-bending work of avant-garde realism that mixes prose poem paragraphs, photographs, scripts for documentary films, reproductions of paintings, lyric essay, and fragmented verse in lines. At the heart of the book is a series of anecdotes that relay in a chilling, numb, detached, second-person voice instances when bruising racial microaggressions surface in the course of daily experience. For example, in one passage, Rankin writes, "Because of your elite status from a year's worth of travel, you have already settled into your window seat on United Airlines when the girl and her mother arrive at your row. The girl, looking over at you, tells her mother, 'These are our seats, but this is not what I expected.' The mother's response is barely audible. 'I see,' she says. 'I'll sit in the middle.'" Or in another passage, "At the end of a brief phone conversation, you tell the manager you're speaking with that you will come by his office to sign the form. When you arrive and announce yourself, he blurts out, 'I didn't know you were black.' 'I didn't mean to say that,' he then says. 'Aloud,' you say. 'What?' he asks. 'You didn't mean to say that aloud.' Your transaction goes swiftly after that." In such moments, Rankin turns up the volume on those barely audible subtexts and undercurrents of daily social interactions, making them newly perceptible and making their awful power tangible. In interviews, Rankin has made it clear that she thinks of Citizen as a work of what I'm calling experimental realism, a piece of documentary poetics. "There's no imagination, actually," she told an interviewer. "Many of the anecdotes in the book were gathered by asking friends of mine to tell me moments when racism surprisingly entered in, when you're among friends or colleagues or just doing some ordinary thing in your day. And then when you start paying attention, it's amazing how many things occur in a single day or week or month." As Rankin suggests, Citizen is driven by an urgent need to pay attention. It's an everyday life project devoted to documenting otherwise invisible everyday incidents and behaviors. Rankin also viscerally demonstrates that subtle acts of racism and discrimination in private daily life exist on a continuum with and ultimately make possible the kind of large-scale tragic events that have shaken American culture in the past several years, such as the killing of Trayvon Martin in Florida, of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Eric Garner in Staten Island, Tamir Rice in Cleveland. In an interview with PBS, Rankin explained the connection between the microaggressions she recounts and, quote, "these major moments, the murders of black men, these kinds of moments in 2014 where you think, how did that happen? And I wanted to track it back and say, well, if people in their daily lives begin by believing and saying these small things, they will add up to major, major aggressions against people just because of the color of their skin. And so the book tracks the small to the large." In this way, Rankin's book exemplifies one of the major themes of Attention Equals Life as a whole. To understand the large, we have an ethical obligation to pay attention to the small. The macro can be, must be, found within the micro. As Citizen attests, the everyday is precisely where politics and power happen, where they're felt by and shape individuals. Across the spectrum of contemporary poetry, one finds a guiding conviction that resonates throughout the tradition of everyday life aesthetics I've traced in this book. Rather than being a realm of the merely insignificant or trivial, rather than being less important than moments of rupture and change, heroism and disaster, the everyday itself is inexhaustibly rich in value, strangeness, and consequence. It's where one can find the most important knowledge about what it means to be human and alive in the modern world. A poetics of everyday life has the potential to help ease the gnawing hunger for the everyday that plagues our distracted culture. It can alter the parameters of what we see and deem important, can make the stone stony, and can reframe the mundane to make it noticeable and vivid. Works of experimental realism remain acutely aware that the dream of mastering the everyday or rendering it, quote, objectively, is a futile goal. And yet they urge us, nevertheless, to wake up and look, really look. They tell us to open our eyes so that the taken for granted features of the quotidian can become legible, even perhaps inescapable. These things do have meaning. They're strong as rocks. Thank you. Thank you, guys.